This week, fake CCTV cameras costing Moscow $17 million. TSA caught lying about the security of naked airport scanning images. And U.S. citizens being arrested on a technicality for recording police in public. This is Pirate Party Radio Episode 11 for Thursday, January 14th, 2010.
The procurement document was recently obtained by EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
We think it's obvious the machines are designed to store and record images.
The TSA's been lying?
Yes. I would use a more polite word if I could, but it would be less accurate.
The document specifies that to protect privacy, during passenger screening, there will be no storage or exporting of images. But EPIC fears that the ability to save images during the test mode leaves open the potential for abuse by insiders and outsiders. The TSA says there is no way for someone in the airport environment to put the machine into the test mode or change the privacy filters. The TSA says all images are deleted from the system after they're reviewed by a remotely located operator, and it says the machines are not networked and cannot be hacked.
But the scale of the scam was huge. It wasn't just one or two cameras, but thousands of them, and a huge amount of footage was faked.
We conducted an investigation from May to September 2009 and found around 29,000 non-functioning CCTV cameras in one of the districts in Moscow, which the servicing company claimed were working. This allowed the company to charge around $1 million for service not provided. Video footage was coming, even from the buildings that no longer existed.
The discovery of this scam will raise serious questions as to how this was able to happen without anyone noticing, seriously undermining the safety and security the CCTV was supposed to provide.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And off the top of the show, we had some clips about the new questions on body scanners at the airports, and some fake CCTV cameras in Moscow, both of which I will be talking about later in the news. And we have an incoming message from Ryan Martin. I'm Minister of the United States of Pirate Party, and I'm paraphrasing his email. It's, I saw on my Facebook page that a friend used the Friend Finder feature to let Facebook scan his contacts to try and find his friends. And he sent me an attached screenshot. And I think this showed up on a lot of people, well, everybody's probably Facebook page. Right at the top, it said these people used Friend Finder to find, you know, their friends. And I think what this does, I didn't use it, but what it does is that you put in your email address and password, it goes to your contacts and finds all of your contacts' email addresses and matches them up with people that are already on Facebook. So really, you're giving Facebook your password and your email address. Well, usually a lot of people do anyway. Go on. Now that the deployment of Facebook has become so great, should we just try and flood the system with everything we can in hopes that it will start devaluing our private data? And that's from Ryan Martin, administrator for the U.S. Pirate Party. Well, that's an interesting proposition, and it's not a bad idea. But for Facebook, of course, it's against their terms of service to give them false information. And also, it really kind of encourages your real information as well when you go to the page. But on that page, all you have is your friends on that page. So if you give false information on your page to your friends are going to be able to, you know, sort through the false information. So it's not a bad idea to overload Facebook with false information, because at least they won't have your real information. Or the better way is to give as much information as you would be comfortable posting on a signboard in the public square of your local town. So stuff that is not really private, stuff that you would make public to anyone. It's very foolish to post private things to a company that has shareholders or a private company, because even if they're not going to release it themselves, how secure is their data? Can anybody ever get to it? Is somebody going to be leave a laptop lying around with your data? So just imagine that anything that you're giving to a company could be released into the hands of the public. So just be careful whenever you do that. You release as much as you're willing to release, and don't give it anything that's too private. If you need to correspond privately to one of your friends, either do it in person or use some encryption that you know is to be decently safe, in your opinion. So if you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at PiratePartyRadio.com and fill out the feedback form, and I'll include it on the show. So on to the news. In pirate news, privacy. Can your comments affect your credit? So this ties into Facebook and other social networking sites, or anything that you post on the internet. And this was also sent in by Ryan Martin of the Pirate Party of the US, the administrator. And this is from sfgate.com. Did you know that everything you and those in your network do and discuss online may be compiled and provided to creditors? If your settings are tuned to public, it's true. This includes your Facebook status updates, Twitter tweets, joining online clubs, linking a website, and even posting a comment on a news blog. And it says, such as, well, this one. It's fascinating stuff. Here's my full story that came out today. Social networking, your key to easy credit. But in brief, what's going on? In hopes of identifying good credit customers, some financial institutions are tapping into the information you and your friends reveal online. The idea is that the friends that you keep and the data you disclose may help them make more accurate business decisions. Who is doing it? Companies such as Rapleaf Hunt and gather social networking transmissions, tuning the conversations you have in your network into customer profiles. These profiles provide the banks with insight into your behavior patterns, what you like and dislike, want and don't want, do well and do poorly. How it's being used. There are a couple of ways this information may be applied. It can help creditors promote certain products, cutting down on marketing waste. Why send pre-approval letters to people not interested, right? Lowering the lending risk is another reason. Creditors can see if people in your network have accounts with them and are free to look at how they're handling those accounts. The presumption is if those in your network are responsible cardholders, there's a better chance that you will be too. So they're judging you on your friends that you keep. So if a bank is on the fence whether to extend your credit, you may be eligible if those in your network are good credit customers. Having a robust online social network can also expedite loan acceptance. If you're connected to a lot of people who are great credit risks, it can speed you through the process. Amazing, isn't it? What you can do. While financial institutions or companies that gather your online data are empathetic that the idea is to increase the odds of a person getting credit, what you reveal online can have unintended consequences. Therefore, if you want to opt out, turn all of your settings to private. Other best practices. Don't accept invitations to your social networking site from people until you check their profiles out first. Be acutely aware of what you write. Don't make public anything you don't want public. take an annual inventory of all your social networking sites and delete people and information that could potentially damage you in the eyes of a creditor or employer. There is a problem to going completely underground, of course, if you're like me and want to be found. I couldn't conduct my business as well without being public. You won't be. So another thing to do is to game the system. Ryan Martin said in his email is to try and flood the system with everything so we can start devaluing our private data. Well, how about flooding the system in the opposite direction so you can add value to your private data? So when these people do strip mine your data information, they're getting not just false information, but good false information in your benefit. So you can start making social networking sites with your friends' accounts and also getting your friends to boost up their relative worth in the eyes of creditors on the internet. So why not game them at their own system? If they're going to use your data, give them data that they can use. It may not be true data, but it may be exaggerated data. So that's an interesting twist on that. So it's good to know who you're dealing with and who has your data and who can gather your data. So you can make a private account and then a public creditor account and make the private one all the stuff that you want to talk to about your friends and make your public one really, you know, jazz yourself up. Make yourself look good. Next story, copyright news from the U.S. This is posted by a salad in Ayasalad, hope I'm pronouncing that right, in the Pirate Party of Canada forums. The motion picture industry is not a cartel, judge rules in the Real DVD case. It's from betanews.com. For years, Real Networks has wanted to produce and sell a product called Real DVD that would enable the legal owners of DVD movies to copy their content onto a hard disk drive, in order that the original disc may stay protected like archival copies. Movie studios responded in September 2008 by suing Real, alleging that its technology intentionally circumvented their copy control system. A circumvention that violated the U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act that led to an injunction barring any sale of Real DVD, which is still in force today. Real then responded with a countersuit, blasting the movie studios with an allegation that they were leveraging the DMCA as a platform on which to build a kind of cartel, a mechanism that disables viewers and the companies that sell to viewers from using DVDs in any other way besides direct viewing that doesn't involve a licensing agreement. Last Friday, the judge in that ongoing suit ruled that Real has not proven the basis of its argument, noting that at any time, Real was free to enter into its own individual licensing for copying DVDs, and there's nothing to stop it from doing so. As Real stated in its defense at the time, Real Networks believed then, as it does now, that a consumer who has purchased, for example, an Iron Man DVD does not need to further permission from Paramount to copy that DVD onto her hard drive so as to get the benefit of additional features that can only be provided by saving to a hard drive. But Judge Marilyn Hall Patel ruled Friday that just because Real believed that there's no need to purchase a license did not prevent from negotiating to purchase a license. Thus, movie studios could not have collectively prevented Real from making a copy mechanism possible, since the alternative negotiation was there and always has been there. The studio argued that any injury to Real has been caused by Real's own illegal behavior and that the court's resulting injunction rather than any anti-competitive behavior, wrote Judge Patel. The only harm alleged by Real is the delay of its product launch. Real decided to delay the launch of product until September 30, 2008, while it attempted to address the studio's defendants' concerns regarding that product. The product was launched on September 30th, but the sale and distribution of Real DVD was enjoined days later by the court's temporary restraining order. The ongoing delay in marketing Real DVD 2 results from the TRO and preliminary injunction entered by this court. Any assertion by Real that the studio's refusal to license the copying of DVDs caused an antitrust injury apart from the delay resulting from the injunction relief is contradicted by Real's assertion that it's believed no license was necessary, etc., etc., etc. Skip to the bottom. Real has alleged that one of the purposes of alleged cartel was to corner the market for unprotected content, specifically the digital copies included with many deluxe DVD and Blu-ray packages today. But Judge Patel concluded that the very existence of such digital copies implied the studios were not using CSS copy protection to form a blockade through which only certain licensees may pass, as Real has also alleged earlier. As a result, the court has dismissed Real Network's claim of antitrust violations on the part of the motion picture industry. The basis of the case, however, whether Real or anyone will be able to market a product like Real DVD continues. I see that they're actually sidestepping the real issue here, which is whether a consumer can legally back up this the piece of software or the movie that they have purchased. And in this case, the average consumer cannot legally back up their DVD in case the original gets scratched. They have purchased this DVD and able to watch it, making a backup copy so that in case the original gets scratched, does not devalue the money that was given to the original a copyright holder. So there is no legal way to make a backup copy without violating DMCA rules. So they're not even addressing whether it's even possible that a consumer can do this. And because they have provided some other means, the digital copies that they include, which are also DRM'd out the wazoo, doesn't really forgive that you still can't make a backup copy of it from the original DVD. You have to buy their special versions with the digital copies. Not all of them include this. So there still is no solution, even though the motion pictures was decried as not being a cartel. The next story, censorship news from Mexico. Narco culture invades Tijuana. Government fights back with a ban. The sentence by Ryan Martin. This is from SDNN.com. You can identify drug smugglers and gang members in Tijuana by some of their customs. They play loud music in trendy new SUVs, wear notorious jewelry and brand-name clothes like American Eagle, Aeropostal, or Ed Hardy, gather at seafood restaurants with live entertainment, and worship death. Santa Muerte in Spanish. The narco culture, or the social acceptance for drug dealers and gangs, is not new, but has gotten worse, says Guillermo Alonso, anthropologist in the Department of Cultural Studies at Northern Border College. Even in old stories, Tijuana is related with drugs and violence, he said. But in recent years, a significant part of the community has shown support for criminal acts and its perpetrators. Society has adopted attitudes and behaviors that in past years were considered offensive, blasphemous, but are now taken quite naturally, said Tijuana Police Chief Julian Lezalo. We used to the point at the drug addicts or the junkies in the street. But with a narco culture and a sort of tolerance to drugs, our society has lost the fear of illegality, and those who are junkies are now socially accepted. Right now, our kids in the streets hanging out with these kind of people. Even for women, the position of a drug dealer guy is attractive. They're visualizing the gang leader as a hero because everybody respects him. And the kids are learning to dress and talk like them, and they want to be like them. They listen to the kind of music they like, and they follow their lead. Leonzo believes that this social phenomena is rampant throughout Mexico, but is more dangerous in the northern border cities due to the proximity of the United States. In an attempt to counteract the social acceptance of narco-culture, the local government recently approved a law that will control narco-corridos, the music that tells stories of drug smugglers. I believe it is time to convince society to avoid these criminals, because everybody could be a victim of them. Those who are classified by some as urban heroes are bad people, say Lezalo. Under the new law, Tijuana's local government will not authorize massive concerts or presentations by bands that perform narco corridos. It also rules out that the transmission of this type of music in urban transport vehicles, such as buses and taxis. The creator of the law, Tijuana council member Luis Moreno, explained that they are trying to control the music that tells the stories of people who traffic drugs or use firearms to harm society. Objects that glorify death used in the Santa Muerte customs are popular on the streets of Tijuana. Those songs highlight crimes, easy money, prostitution, drug addiction, and even the killing of police officers. That entire our environment is what we are banning. The law also regulates the type of music that is going to be performed in local events. There are bands and singers that come out to our city to make an apology for crime, violence, and death, and we will not tolerate this kind of presentation, he said. So, in effect, they are banning certain phrases and words in songs and disguising it under the guise of being able to fight the drug war by banning music. I don't think this is going to work. And are they also going to ban sea shanties in an effort to combat, you know, piracy on the high seas? This might be a failing attempt to blame something that's easy and to get rid of something that's easy by destroying local culture through music and trying to put on a good face for the public by doing something in quotations rather than going after the actual drug dealers. They're going after musicians. And really, do musicians have the time to be drug dealers? Are those the criminals? Is the musicians? Or is it the actual people who deal the drugs? In open government news from the U.S., police fight cell phone recordings. This is sent in by Weondi and Ryan Martin of the Pirate Party of the U.S. from Boston.com. Simon Glick, a lawyer, was walking down Tremont Street in Boston when he saw three police officers struggling to extract a plastic bag from a teenager's mouth. Thinking their force seemed excessive for a drug arrest, Glick pulled out his cell phone and began recording. Within minutes, Glick said he was in handcuffs. One of the officers asked me whether my phone has audio recording capabilities. Glick, 33, said recently of the incident, which took place in October 2007. Glick acknowledged that it did, and then he said, "My phone was seized and I was arrested." The charge? Illegal electronic surveillance. John Cermax, 34, experienced a similar situation, thinking that Boston police officers were unnecessarily rough while breaking up a holiday party in Brighton he was attending. In December 2008, he took out his cell phone and began recording. Police confronted Cermax, a webmaster at Boston University. He was arrested and, like Glick, charged with illegal surveillance. There are no hard statistics for video recording arrests, but the experience of Cermax and Glick highlight what civil libertarians call a troubling misuse of the state's wiretapping law to stifle the kind of street-level oversight that cell phone and video technology make possible. The police apparently do not want witnesses to what they do in public, said Sarah Wunsch, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, who helped get the criminal charges against Cermax dismissed. Boston police spokeswoman Elaine Driscoll rejected the notion that police are abusing the law to block citizen oversight, saying that the department trains officers about the wiretap law. If an individual is inappropriately interfering with an arrest that could cause harm to an officer or another individual, an officer's primary responsibility is to ensure the safety of the situation, she said. In 1968, Massachusetts became a two-party consent state, one of 12 currently in the country. Two-party consent means that all parties to a conversation must agree to be recorded on a telephone or other audio device, otherwise the recording of the conversation is illegal. The law, intended to protect the privacy rights of individuals, appears to be triggered by a series of high-profile cases involving private detectives who were recording people without their consent. In arresting people such as Glick and Cermax, police are saying that they have not consented to being recorded, and that their privacy rights have therefore been violated, and that citizen action was criminal. The statute has been misconstrued by the Boston police, said June Jensen, a lawyer who represented Glick and succeeded in getting his charges dismissed. The law, she says, did not prohibit public recording of anyone. You could go to the Boston Common and snap pictures and record if you want. You can do that. Ever since the police beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles in 1991 was videotaped, and with the advent of media sharing websites like Facebook and YouTube, the practice of openly recording police activity has been commonplace. But in Massachusetts and other states, the arrests of street videographers, whether they use cell phones or other video technology, offers a dramatic illustration of the collision between new technologies and police practices. Police are not used to ceding power, and these tools are forcing them to cede power, said David Argia, director of the Citizen Media Law Project at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Ardia said the proliferation of cell phone and other technology has equipped people to record actions in public. As a society, we should be asking ourselves whether we want to make that into a criminal activity. In Pennsylvania, another two-party state, individuals using cell phone to record police activities have also ended up in police custody. But one Pennsylvania jurisdiction has reaffirmed individuals' right to videotape in public. Police in Spring City and East Vincent Township agreed to adopt a written policy confirming the legality of videotaping police while on duty. The policy was hammered out as part of a settlement between authorities and ACLU attorneys representing a Spring City man who's been arrested several times last year for following police and taping them. In Massachusetts, Wunsch said Attorney General Martha Coakley and police chiefs should be informing officers not to abuse the law by charging civilians with illegally recording them in public. The cases are the court's concern, said Coakley spokesman Harry Pierre. At this time, the office has not issued any advisory or opinion on this issue. So, what is the lesson here? The lesson is to disconnect your audio attachment on your video camera. Disable the speaker before videotaping police in the two-party law. Well, both people need to be informed of it, because it only applies to audio recording and not video recording in those places. A two-party state is what it's called. So disconnect your microphone before recording the police in those places. So be very careful in those two-party places, and I guess in all the other states in the U.S., it's a one party or no party. I don't know if there's any no party ones. That means you can record two people unaware to having a conversation. So look up in your local state laws about this, because it seems a little hypocritical that they can set up CCTV cameras recording your every move throughout your town, but you can't record a supposed abuse of police power in your own city. So it's a little bit one-sided. So if you're going to go and do this, make sure you read up on your local laws for your state before doing this, or province in Canada or around the world. Copyright news from the Philippines. Group needs guns to enforce intellectual property rights is from torrentfreak.com. As a nationwide gun ban took effect yesterday in the Philippines to reduce political violence as the country's elections draw near, an anti-piracy group has asked for an exemption. The director says that having firearms is essential for holding investigation and enforcing intellectual property rights. Elections in the Philippines have a history of being violent affairs. As recently as 2009, a convoy of 40 people was hijacked by gunmen, resulting in the deaths of 13 women and 8 men. Some of the victims were beheaded and mutilated. As May's elections draw closer, already there has been reports of killings and attacks on candidates, many of them with firearms. In order to dampen down this violence, the government implemented a nationwide firearms ban yesterday, setting up 3,500 checkpoints staffed by 100,000 soldiers and police officers. Quite wisely, these uniformed individuals are now the only people allowed to carry guns, and even off-duty policemen must comply. Already three government officials have been arrested for breaches. There is one group, however, that think these temporary laws shouldn't apply to them. The Optical Media Board, a civilian outfit which tries to combat piracy and copyright violations, has written to the Commission on Election asking that its officers be given an exemption from the ban. According to the OMB, Executive Director Anthony Leongzon, his staff needs firearms for conducting investigation, carrying out raids, and for other activities related to tackling piracy and violations of intellectual property rights. Leongzon put forward the names of 150 of his staff who want to be exempted from the law and allowed to carry pistols, revolvers, shotguns, and rifles. Amazingly, some staff have up to 7 firearms. It seems pretty clear that the government is serious about this firearms ban and avoiding bloodshed, but surely fighting the non-violent act of discopying shouldn't warrant an exemption, or should it? People using weapons to fight over oil almost constantly, so since intellectual property is now the oil of the 21st century, perhaps this is the appropriate response after all. Very frightening that a non-police organization is asking for an exemption for firearms to carry out copyright enforcements. Imagine these non-policemen coming to your door asking if to seize your computer with guns in their hands. Now, this is extremely frightening that it's even being considered. Now, it doesn't say that it's going to pass. It just says that they've asked for it, but it seems a little far-fetched. And now it doesn't go into detail about the climate of piracy in the Philippines, whether this is very highly organized, whether they're talking about like a organized discopying underground selling on the street kind of thing, or they're talking about a citizen kind of downloading off the internet type of copyright violations. But it's hard to tell, but it is scary nonetheless. Censorship and privacy news from China. Researchers identify command servers behind Google attack. Now, probably a lot of you have already heard about Google wanting to pull out of China. They've uncensored their Google search, or are in the process of decensorizing their, if that's a word, decensorizing their Google search on google.cn. I don't know how far that's come, but they made a very public blog post about it, so I thought I'd skip over that story, because you can all read about it on your own, and go to the more interesting story about the about the privacy news and the censorship and what's happening behind the scenes, why that they're pulling out of China. VeriSign's iDefense Security Lab has published a report with technical details about the recent cyber attack that hit Google and 30 other companies. The iDefense researchers traced the attack back to its origin and also identified the command and control servers that were used to manage the malware. The cyber assault came to light on Tuesday when Google disclosed to the public that the Gmail web service was targeted in a highly organized attack in late December. Google said that the intrusion attempt originated from China and was executed with the goal of obtaining information about political dissidents, but the company declined to speculate about the identity of the perpetrator. Citing sources in the defense contracting and intelligent consulting community, the iDefense report unambiguously declares that the Chinese government was, in fact, behind the effort. The report also says the malicious code was deployed in PDF files that were crafted to exploit a vulnerability in Adobe software. The source IPs and drop server of the attack corresponded to a single foreign entity consisting either of the agents of the Chinese state or proxies thereof, the report says. The researchers have determined that there are significant similarities between the recent attack and seemingly related one that was carried out in July against a large number of U.S. companies. Both attacks were apparently managed through the same command and control servers. The servers used in both attacks employ the Home Linux Dynamic DNS provider, and both are currently pointed to IP addresses owned by Linode, a U.S.-based company that offers virtual private server hosting. The IP addresses in question are within the same subnet, and there are 6 IP addresses apart from each other, report says. Considering the proximity, it is possible that the 2 attacks are one and the same, and that the organizers are and that the organizations targeted in the Silicon Valley attacks have been compromised since July. If the report's findings are correct, it suggests that the government of China has been engaged for months in a massive campaign of industrial espionage against U.S. companies. Now, is this really a surprise that the country of China, whose censorship is so heavy-handed, that they would go into people's private email accounts to look for political dissidents? They already control what you see through the Google website. Is it really that far of a next step that they would go so far as to invade the privacy of the email of its own countrymen? So something to watch out for, and thankfully Google is withdrawing from that place, from China, or are proposing to withdraw if there's any flack over its new uncensored Google search in China. So it's something to watch out for in the coming weeks. In net neutrality news, REM Everybody Hurts Without Network Neutralities from ArsTechnica.com. Net neutrality isn't just an issue for policy wonks and communication lawyers. And the boys from REM want the FCC to know how crucial a neutral net remains for artists of all stripes. Or to put it another way, it's the end of the world as we know it without network neutrality. In comments filed with the FCC this week, the band recounted the bad old days in Athens, Georgia, stuffing envelopes and mailing out issues of their fan newsletter a few thousand copies at a time. These were the days of Xerox copies and homemade fanzines, self-addressed stamped envelopes, carbon sheets in triplicate, brother typewriters, and desk calendars, said the band. From the standpoint of communication, they were good only in that they had nothing on which to compare them. Then came the internet, and REM collectively felt like shiny, happy people. Apologies for this news story. It's very cheesy and tongue-in-cheek. The new distribution was a wake-up bomb, exploding all over the old ways of doing business, enabling a much closer connection to the fans. Today, just like every band in the second decade of the millennium, REM is armed to the hilt with the latest requisite web-based tools, which make communication with fans not only easy, but fast. It's a structure dependent on bandwidth. Website hits, downloads, Twitter accounts, blogs, fanzines, RSS feeds, Facebook and MySpace pages, apps, YouTube channels, Fidget, and HTML newsletters. Net neutrality is automatic for the people. How does this relate to net neutrality? Well, the sidewinder may be sleeping tonight, but tomorrow he could wake up and bite you in the foot, so to speak, and then your foot would swell up and have to be amputated, and then you would be footless. Okay. Minus open access to the convenience and immediacy of the web-based social networking tools, it's not so hard to imagine a return to a time when they weren't around, writes the band. So let's preserve the seamless flow of information between artist and fan, and recognize that net neutrality is critical to the conservation of this dynamic. It doesn't matter if you're a band or the blogger, and the open internet provides access to the same platform for communication as a large corporation, or even a government agency. REM opposes any structures that will prohibit this access. So what they're talking about, in essence, is that they don't want the large corporations to be able to outbid the small hosting companies of small bands that are trying to promote themselves. In essence, taking over the bandwidth of the smaller hosting sites in order to drown out any competition between the large corporate sponsored bands and the small independent bands, because they have been there on both ends of the spectrum. Some bands just start up from nothing and make it huge, but some bands, such as REM, start up from a small fan base and build their way up, and they understand how they could be drowned out in this sea of bought bandwidth that net neutrality is trying to preserve. So it's nice to have artists that can speak up for the common person and put a voice and a face to net neutrality and show what kind of effects that it could have on society when all you get is corporate music if net neutrality falls apart. Copyright news from the UK. Digital economy bill to be watered down. This is from timesonline.co.uk. A government bill that would give Lord Mandelson, the business secretary, sweeping new powers to amend copyright laws will be watered down tomorrow after complaints from internet giants including Google and Yahoo. Ministers will put forth a series of amendments to the digital economy bill, which contains flagship plans to fight internet piracy. After Facebook, Google, Yahoo, and eBay wrote to Lord Mandelson warning of their grave concerns over Bill's Clause 17. Although the bill's main focus is on fighting peer-to-peer file sharing, ministers say that other areas of online copyright infringements are developing, and they want to future-proof the bill by giving the Secretary of State new powers to amend copyright designs and patents of 1988. We believe that the bill's Clause 17 opens the way for arbitrary measures, the companies complained. This power could be used, for example, to increase monitoring of user data even when no illegal practice has taken place. Both the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats have attacked the proposals, and the government will tomorrow offer a compromise. It is understood that the ministers will back an amendment tabled by Lord Bragg and Lord Putnam that would make any proposed change to the copyright laws subject to more rigorous parliamentary scrutiny, including a 60-day consultation period. Ministers would also have to subject copyright proposals to an evidential test to show that Britain's film and music industries would be harmed without the changes. They would also have to consult with consumer groups before changing copyright laws. The bill still faces a tight parliamentary time frame to become law before an election. The new government's position shows that ministers are set on keeping Clause 17, despite suspicions that it will be a sacrificial lamb to be discarded in the last-minute negotiations. The music industry has proposed a compromise position in which, instead of the controversial clause, the courts would be given powers to block illicit websites that hosted copyright material, but ministers rejected the proposal after it was leaked to journalists. A spokesman for the Department of Business said the government remains squarely behind the aims of Clause 17. We would not have written it into the bill if we did not think it was needed. So thankfully, there are some dissenting voices about this restrictive bill that is going in. Being proposed in the UK. So it's good that there's some large corporations fighting for our side for once and trying to defeat this very onerous and restrictive bill that is trying to be proposed. In privacy news, Titan Tracer, a useful analytics software or invasion of privacy? It's from mattbusey.com. Recently, I learned about a product called Titan Tracer. It's a small piece of JavaScript you can embed in your website, and it appears to have two main benefits. You can track what text people are copying off your site. And when people paste that text elsewhere, it adds a read more note with the URL of the article the text came from. The benefits of this to webmasters are obvious. You can see what text people are most often copying from your site, and you can use it to track plagiarists. When you keep people see your read more URL upon pasting the copied text, they are reminded that it might be worthwhile to attribute the information to your site. On one website using Titan Tracer is the Daily Mail. Try it out. Go to a mail article, copy some text, more than just a few words, and paste it into a text editor. You should see the read more note. Should websites using Titan Tracer inform the reader they're using it? Many sites, including this one, use some sort of analytics software to monitoring what people are reading. Webmasters use this data for a variety of reasons, determining which articles are the most popular, selling advertisements, or simply satisfying curiosity. Most do not overtly tell readers that they're using such software. I believe that most people these days assume their web surfing habits are being watched to some degree. Titan Tracer is really just another kind of analytics software. So what's the hang up? When I request and view a web page, my computer is contacting another person's computer to retrieve that information. So it seems logical that the activity could be tracked. But, and perhaps this is naive or old-fashioned, when I copy and paste text to my computer, it feels like an activity confined to my computer. I have already retrieved the web page from the site server. What I do with it after that is nobody's business. And to what extent a single person's copying and pasting habits monitored by Titan Tracer? An easy solution for the tech-savvy people is to install NoScript for Firefox and block it, because Titan Tracer is JavaScript-based. But many web surfers don't know about NoScript. So asking them to install a piece of software to protect their privacy, to whatever extent it might be infringed upon by Titan Tracer, is a bit much. So this is brand new to me, and I noticed it while gathering these news stories that this was on about 25% of the web pages I went to. This has spread like wildfire. So there's a real drill down now of tracking of what users are doing on websites, whether it's copying a piece of text to go research it further in Google, or being able to trace it and see what people are keeping for later. It's quite unnerving when I found out about this. So at least there is a way to prevent web pages from knowing what you're doing specifically with the words on their page and attaching that kind of tracing to your IP address. So be aware now that they're able to track down to the word what you are reading and using for other purposes on websites. Very scary indeed. So you may want to look into something like NoScript that is able to disable JavaScript-based things like this. And you will go and try it out. Go and try it out on that page that the Daily Mail. And you can see when you paste it, it's not just pasting the words that you copied. It's doing a lot more behind the scenes. And this was from off the top of this news today. Privacy news from Russia. Moscow cameras streamed false pictures. Police have learned that CCTV cameras all across Moscow stream pre-recorded pictures while the company servicing them received more than $1 million in payment. The company Stroy Montage Service has been accused of security fraud. Police have detained its director, Dmitry K., who denies all charges, saying that the scandal is in an attempt by his rivals to squeeze him out of the market. The alleged fraud was uncovered during a routine check of Moscow's CCTV cameras. From May to September 2009, CCTV cameras in several districts of Moscow streamed pre-recorded pictures instead of real-time video, police spokeswoman Olga D. stated on Tuesday. According to contract with Stroy Montage Service, the Moscow government only paid for working cameras. Demalkina said the company unreasonably received about $1 million for the northeastern district alone. Investigators say apart from falsifying pictures, the company also distributed a computer virus in order to obstruct activities of its rival in the western district of the capital. There are more than 80,000 security cameras in public places in Moscow. The project was launched several years ago by Mayor Yuri Lutskov at the cost of $17 million. To add insult to injury about your privacy being eroded by the government, you also are paying for this so-called security by being watched day and night, by not even being watched day and night, paying for nothing where these cameras are set up and are doing absolutely nothing. So if it happens to be that you are get assaulted or something in front of one of these cameras, and you go to the government and say, well, there was a camera right there, I got robbed, do you have any pictures of it? And they'll go, oh, no, we don't. We got ripped off, and all your money went down the drain for these fake cameras sitting around. So this is just insulting. No, we're losing our privacy along with our dollars, and we're not even losing our privacy, so it's really a theater security here. But thankfully this is found out, and maybe they can put in place real cameras instead, which really is not the greatest of things either. We don't need to be watched day and night of all activities everywhere. Copyright news from France. French Three Strikes agency logo violates copyright. So the copyright police are violating copyright themselves. This happens so many times. This is from ZeroPay.com. Agencies to be charged with overseeing the country's controversial plan for disconnecting illegal file sharers from the internet unveils new logo using typeface without permission of the copyright holder. In a delicious bit of irony, the French government agency tasked with enforcing the controversial Three Strikes law that will allow authorities to disconnect illegal file shares from the internet unveiled an official new logo to the public only to discover that it was used without permission of the copyright holder. That's right, Haute Autorité pour la diffusion des œuvres et la protection des droits sur Internet. H-A-D-O-P-I, which I will not pronounce the full-length version of that anymore, itself is guilty of copyright infringement. The logo uses a Bonjour typeface that was created by the graphic designer Jean-François Porcher, whom sold it for exclusive use by France Telecom. The design agency that created the logo for H-A-D-O-P-I admits that it was a mistake and that the design has been since tweaked, but Porsche says that legal action is still an option. My lawyer will contact the Culture Ministry and France Telecom in hopes of finding a solution, he told The Telegraph. The affair is just another example of repeated instances of copyright infringement by the French government and clearly illustrates why the public is so concerned about three-strike sanction. If the government, with all of its legal resources, can make a mistake not once, but no less than four times, counting over the past year alone, what hopes does the average Joe, or Jacques in this case, have? If you recall, first it was accusations by U.S. indie band management last February that the UMP was using its popular song Kids at the party's National Congress and in two online videos and political advertisements without permission. Then France's presidential audio services, the Service Audiovisuel de Présidence de la Republic, was exposed for making some 400 unauthorized copies of the documentary Visages de Découverte, Nicolas Sarkozy. The DVD's producer, Galaxy Press, has apparently only shipped 50 copies to the government agency, well short of what was needed, so it decided to make additional copies on its own, even going so far as to replace the Galaxy Press logo with its own. Fast forward to last month when it was accused by the Canadian Musicore Québécois record label for using a song in a lip-dub video without permission. So it is kind of frightening when the government can't even keep track of copyright themselves, and now it's four times. Three was the limit, so they should be off the internet already. Four, they've gone well over the limit, so maybe we can, when the law goes into effect, they can be retroactively kicked off the internet for three copyright violations. So that is frightening when, how, like it says in the article, how is the average person supposed to keep track of copyright violations when copyright is so, it's not even thought of anymore in day-to-day activities. Everything everywhere is copyrighted and people are just used to being able to time shift things and record things and use things in their everyday life without lawyers descending upon them. And so this is certainly frightening. Next story, net neutrality news from the U.S. EFF weighs in on proposed FCC net neutrality rules. It's from EFF.org. So far, implementation of the three strikes plan has been delayed until April. Let's hope it becomes delayed permanently. To mark the deadline for the first round of comments for the FCC regarding its proposed net neutrality regulations, here's a quick summary of what the EFF had to say in its comments to the commission. While the question of how best to protect the openness of the internet is a timely and important one, the EFF believes that the FCC currently lacks the statutory authority to issue the broad regulations on ISPs that it has proposed. The ancillary jurisdiction that the FCC has asserted as a basis for the regulations is legally insufficient and would, if accepted, give the FCC potentially unbounded power to regulate the internet however it likes. In other words, if the FCC wants to issue net neutrality regulations, it needs to wait until Congress passes a net neutrality bill. If the Commission nevertheless chooses to forge ahead with the regulations proposed, EFF urges it to make the following revisions designed to protect the free speech and privacy interests of internet users and to foster competition and innovation. First, in order to protect free speech or interests of internet users, the Commission should reject copyright enforcements as reasonable network management. And I'll just do the first sentence of all these because it goes into five different things. So that one's very important. You can't just pass off copyright enforcement as reasonable network management and shutting down people because, oh, it's impacting our network. In order to protect the privacy interest of internet users, the commission should clarify that the law enforcement exception applies only to an ISP's legal obligations to address the needs of law enforcement. Third, in order to protect the privacy of internet users, the commission should make it clear that the proposed regulations do not reach non-commercial providers of broadband internet service, whether they are individuals who operate open Wi-Fi networks at home or public-minded entities that provide free access in their local communities. Fourth, in order to foster competition and innovation, EFF urges the commission to make it clear the proposed transparency principle is not subject to an exception for reasonable network management. Fifth, in order to foster competition and innovation, the Commission should require wireless ISPs to allow tethering as a form of device interconnection. So those are very, very important proposals put forth by the EFF to amend any net neutrality bills and to forego any badly implemented three strikes laws in the U.S. Take a read through the whole proposal there by the EFF. You can find the link in the Pirate Party forums. Copyright news from the U.S. Comcast BitTorrent settlement excludes pirates. Torrent Freak from torrentfreak.com. A few weeks ago, Comcast decided to settle one of the class action lawsuits brought against the ISPs in response to its BitTorrent throttling actions. Affected users can now claim their part of the $16 million fund that was set up, but only if they state under penalty of perjury that BitTorrent was never used to download copyrighted content. After more than 2 years, Comcast BitTorrent throttling practices and their implications for net neutrality are still making the headlines. The company still refuses to admit its wrongdoing and prefers to make its own rules how the internet should be regulated. Their decision to prevent BitTorrent users from sharing content over the network has sparked net neutrality debate, resulting in an FCC investigation and various lawsuits. One of these suits was settled last month. Comcast agreed to put $16 million into a fund to pay BitTorrent users that were affected by the network management, which made it impossible for them to share files after their downloads had completed. Each of the affected users can now claim their $16 in damages, but those who do are required to state to the court, under penalty of perjury, that their use of BitTorrent was for lawful purpose consistent with applicable copyright and other laws. This required statement came as an unpleasant surprise to many affected Comcast users. Am I supposed to remember everything I downloaded during that period and be cognizant of the copyright status of those items not only then, but now, one worried Comcast user told Torrent Freak, I certainly do not think that $16 is enough incentive to possibly suffer the penalties of committing unwitting federal perjury. Other Comcast users will have to agree with this assessment simply because it's often not clear when one is violating copyright law. For example, there's a large portion of BitTorrent users that think that downloading a TV show that they could have watched for free on TV is not a crime. It wouldn't surprise us if a large portion of the $16 million fund is left unclaimed because of this required statement, saving Comcast a significant amount of money. That leads us to the question of why it was included in the first place. It somehow suggests that Comcast was attempting to stop copyright infringement with their throttling practices. Aside from the network management purpose it served, maybe they just want to hang on to their money. Whatever the motivation to include this option, it is completely irrelevant to the case itself. Comcast has never used copyright infringement as a justification for stopping BitTorrent traffic, so the lawfulness of the traffic should not be an issue. Very interesting stuff there. Privacy news from the U.S. Body scans can store and send images, privacy group says. This is from injuryboard.com. This information comes from the Washington-based Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, a public interest group focused on privacy. CNN reports that the group has obtained documents from the Transport Security Administration, TSA, which oversees airport security. The TSA specified in 2008 documents that full-body scanners at airports must have the capability to store and send images. The images provide a graphic outline and details of the body to show whether someone is carrying any metal, plastics, or potentially explosives. That opens a possibility for abuse by TSA employees, according to EPIC's director. How does that square with the TSA video assuring passengers that the system has no way to save, transmit, or print the image? EPIC says the ability to store it and send exists when the machines are in test mode. TSA is promoting the machines as a way to prevent potential for explosive being brought aboard U.S. airlines, such as the Christmas attempt on Northwest flight over Detroit. The TSA should suspend further deployment of the machines until privacy questions are resolved, said EPIC Executive Director Mark Rottenberg, reports CNN. EPIC is pursuing a lawsuit to obtain additional documents about the machine. 40 machines are currently being used at 19 airports domestically. An additional 300 machines should be in use in U.S. airports by 2011. So, my question is it as easy as typing in a password like 1234 to get it into test mode, or is it something even harder? Nonetheless, you can put it into a test mode where you can take the images that are on the screen of naked people's bodies and transmit it or store it somewhere else as it outlines in their documents by the people who make these products, in opposed to what the TSA has released, saying that it's impossible to store or transmit these pictures of people. So, in essence, they're not telling the whole truth, which, if you're not telling the whole truth, then you're kind of telling a lie to the people, especially when you're saying they can't when they can. And in relation to that, in Pirate Party news, Pirate Party protests naked scanners in their underpants. And this was posted by La Salad in the Pirate Party of Canada forum. And this is from thelocal.de. Scantily clad Pirate Party supporters demonstrated over the weekend at several German airports to show their opposition to the controversial naked scanners planned for security checks. Despite the frigid temperatures outside, the protesters assembled nearly naked groups in the airports at Berlin, Frankfurt, and Dusseldorf on Sunday afternoon. The participants stripped down to their underpants, marching behind signs that read, "No need to scan us, we're already naked." A statement on the party's website said that they opposed the new security scanners because they threatened the private sphere and the personal rights of passengers. Germany's Data Protection Commissioner, Peter Schaar, warned officials last week to not rush the implementation of the full-body scanners at airport security stations following a failed terrorist attack in the U.S. last month. Critics are concerned that the devices, which allow security personnel to see through clothing, have not been improved enough to protect passengers' personal rights. Meanwhile, Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservatives said the use of scanners would be fast-tracked for introduction within the year. The German Pirate Party was inspired by the Swedish Pirate Partiet and founded in 2006, not 16 something. In the September 2009 federal election, they garnered 2% of the vote. So good on the Pirate Party of Germany to show what these scanners really are all about, and what they are doing and what they are lying about now. So I don't know if they knew about this last story before they went there, but hopefully they did, and they can educate some people at the airports of what's going on and how their privacy is being invaded and lied about. The Pirate Party UK internal party elections are happening soon. And this is from, obviously, the Pirate Party UK site. As promised in the forums, we're holding elections for the Pirate Party's official party's officer roles this month. While the officers were originally elected to serve a 2-year term, we all agreed that it would be good for the party for there to be an opportunity to change direction if needed between the party's formation and the first election it takes part in. So if you're in the UK and you're a member of the Pirate Party or want to be, sign up and take part in these elections so you can vote on who is running the Pirate Party UK. So, if you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions, or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the website. So, thank you for listening. And until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.